I'm Carrington Vanston.
I'm Earl Evans.
And I'm David Grealish. Items of interest in news, vintage computer commercials, retro computing gift idea, eBay auctions, and more today on the Retro Computing Roundtable for Sunday, March 3rd, 2013. The RCR is brought to you by Cyber Ears. How was that?
Very nice. That was awesome.
Everyone, that's our 60 minutes intro. Just
it's so
keep it around.
I don't want to use the word professional because it's not. I want to use
Well, I'm going to add in the ticking sound in the audio version.
Yeah, that'll for sure get us sued. So,
how are you guys doing today?
Good. I'm good.
On one angles. Thumb. One half thumb for me.
You doing good, Earl? Thinkings. Yeah.
How dare you? That look offensive. Yeah.
It does, doesn't it? But it's not. It doesn't mean anything.
All right. Let's get closer.
Now, we're on video.
Oh, sorry, audio people. I was doing my next to my middle fingers there.
Yes.
But all right, so let's get going. We had adopted a new thing for the show where the host gets to pick sort of a host topic. So I have chosen all-in-one office suites or works suites, which were kind of popular in the late 80s, early 90s. And I guess Microsoft Works went on to be around for some years afterwards, but they kind of faded out by the mid-90s. And, of course, Microsoft Office has taken over, you know, forever since then. You guys ever used any of the work suites?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I used ClarisWorks quite a bit for a number of years. So that was my works suite of choice on the Mac many, many, many years ago. Strangely, as a real Apple II fanboy, I mean, complete. Never used AppleWorks.
And I didn't put that on the list, but... I didn't use it either, but you're right. That's the mother of the works, really, isn't it?
I have a couple of copies of it now, so I will be eventually checking it out. But I've never actually used AppleWorks on the Apple II. There were whole mugs for it and everything. I mean, that's a major piece of software, and I missed it completely.
How about you, Earl?
Well, I did use one of the early integrated packages called Lotus Symphony. I'm not sure if it was the first. I don't think so, but it definitely was one of the first on the DOS platform. And it was okay, but, you know, didn't really take off because, and this may be something that you guys end up discussing.
We will end up discussing.
we always do. But the individual pieces of these composite packages usually lack the power of the standalone things. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, with Works, your spreadsheet, your word processor wasn't obviously as powerful as the standalone Word or the standalone Excel. And I think particularly in Symphony's case, people just didn't see the value proposition.
But you can see why they came around originally in the days before, as I like to think of it, Multifinder. So the days before you could easily run multiple window-based applications at the same time on your OS, the way we totally take for granted doing today. Mm-hmm. Back when you had command line-based interfaces, flat file, you know, floppy disk operating systems running one program at a time that took the whole window, it was really convenient to have something that could do both word processing and spreadsheet in one program instead of having to switch back and forth between them. Once I got computer operating systems at work that would just let me run multiple programs and swap data between them, it was far easier just to select the word processor I wanted, separately the spreadsheet I wanted. Of course, most people just then selected the Office suite, so it really didn't make much of a difference.
Yeah, and that was, for me, because I was a Mac user, and I was a Mac Plus essential user with 1 meg of RAM. So I'm going to cheat a little bit because we are mostly an audio podcast. So for our audio listeners, please go take a quick look at this segment on YouTube, and you can see when I'm showing up to the camera. So this isn't the original one. I mean, this wasn't my original one, but this is the original package that I started using. So Microsoft Works 2.0 for the Mac. And so I used this for at least, I don't know, a year and a half or so. And then when I bought my first color Mac, it came with ClarisWorks. So I think this is maybe version 2 or 3. But ClarisWorks was great. And yeah, they did come out with a PC version of ClarisWorks too, if you guys remember. Windows 95 version.
Yeah, I think they only sold like 6 copies though. So.
But what was neat about ClarisWorks was instead of it being it sort of went to the Lisa model, I think, where instead of it being application centric, it was document centric. If you remember, Carrington, you could start off with a Word processing document or a spreadsheet, whatever, and then you could switch over to one of the other tools and embed it in that document.
Yeah, just like a spreadsheet. For me, it was a precursor. I guess it was a precursor. It's hard to remember the dates to the whole CyberDog and OpenDoc movement.
Yeah,
that I got really excited about, and then it went nowhere. I used to have a CyberDog pen that I really, really liked, and I destroyed it during the filming of a film once. I was Tanya Smith. She wrecked my pen. So I was a big fan. So CyberDog, that whole OpenDoc idea was that you would just have a document, and instead of massive programs, you would just essentially have small programs that would do a task. It's a charting thing. It's a word processing thing, that kind of stuff. And then you would just bring in the tools needed to apply to the document. It just unfortunately never went anywhere, but I was excited about the idea.
What was it also called on the Mac? It was like publish, subscribe, and publish. Wasn't that the technology
so
around that time too?
As well, the whole subscribe. And so you would, I mean, that whole movement. I mean, all these things that Apple tried in those years, it was kind of floundering. I remember publish and subscribe and working with that. That would always seem to break on me. It was such a kludgy way to go. I liked ClarisWorks though. I was always a fan of that. It's always seemed to me in all of these works suites, they seem to be such a compromise over dedicated software. So, and it was just the nature of having to build all those tools in. You seem to not get a great version of any single tool. But I used to use ClarisWorks. At the same time, stuff like MacWrite was around, or MacWrite Pro, which was a fantastic word processor. I loved MacWrite Pro, and that's Nisus and that kind of stuff. Some really good word processors. So ClarisWorks was good, but I would always be aware that I couldn't do things that I could have done in MacWrite Pro.
I was going to say on the publish and subscribe thing, or the way like two different documents or programs could talk to each other. What was that called in Microsoft Office? It was called something where they could communicate with each other.
They probably just copied it. It was also called publish and subscribe, but they spelled it differently.
Or was it called OLE?
They had OLE, yeah.
Is that what it was?
They had OLE embedding.
Okay.
OLE.
Well, so just a couple more on the show, and these are all Mac-related. So I didn't actually use these or own them, but I think this one's pretty neat, and I don't think it did that well. You know, ClarisWorks was the top one on the Mac, but BeagleWorks, which I'm not mistaken, later on WordPerfect bought, and it became WordPerfectWorks.
Interesting. I've never even heard of BeagleWorks. I mean, obviously I know Beagle Brothers and their awesomeness for the Apple II, but I don't know BeagleWorks for the Mac.
Mm-hmm. So for the Mac. And then lastly, last show we mentioned, I mentioned about a company I worked for, or a company that was called TML, and they made the Macintosh Toolbox. They made like a Pascal version and all that. Remember, Carrington?
Yes.
And so I worked for them for a little while in Jacksonville, Florida. So TML stood for Thomas, and his middle name, Leonard. And then they went on to change their name to Leonard Development Group. And before ClarisWorks came out, I was a beta tester for them for a software called SmartWorks. And I think they only barely released it, and then they immediately sold it to Symantec, and it then became GreatWorks.
Right.
And it did not. Once ClarisWorks came out, it pretty much killed any other competition for works kind of stuff. But I'd recently, you know, not recently, a couple of years ago, I got a copy of GreatWorks, which is, you know, kind of neat.
The works package, I'm in a sense most. I think I encountered the most was Microsoft Works, mostly because it became the thing that was bundled on computers. And it would always
be on your
crappy Celeron PC computer, they would throw in a copy of Microsoft Works that you would then have to try to get rid of to put on decent software. Yeah, I was never a fan of Microsoft Works.
And I guess just to finish off this topic, and then I guess would it have been maybe the late 90s or when you started seeing the open source works, you know, for Linux, and well, of course I guess it exists for Linux,
which
but for Windows
exists,
too, and Mac. Yeah, OpenOffice, which... was it OpenOffice? Wasn't it called something else before that?
I only know it as OpenOffice.
Or it was like Novell had it, or... Anyway, so
OpenOffice, now it's morphed into, there's a couple of forks of it now. Because of the Oracle ownership of it, a lot of the Linux distributions have forked off into something called LibreOffice for free office. And work there seems to be possibly developing a little faster than on the open office stuff. Just going back for a second to your point, Carrington, you kind of forget over the years how things were way back then when you didn't have multitasking operating systems. That mm-hmm. was a really good point that it was. Especially on a floppy system, swapping back and forth. So, we used Lotus 1-2-3 for our spreadsheets. We used something called Multimate. Have you guys ever heard of Multimate for processing? So, man, switching between those two programs, you obviously couldn't get data in between the two without some fairly extreme shenanigans. And
it was Earl Evans story.
Shutting one down, bringing another up, Man, monotasking computing makes you want to get out and push.
And I know we're missing, there's other ones that we're missing here, and I want to think of, what was the Tandy one? Remember the Tandy 1000 and stuff came with...
Well, and Rob Clark put in the chat box here about the 3-in-1 software on the Commodore Plus 4. Commodore actually introduced a 3-in-1 software on ROM on their Commodore Plus 4 computer. It's one of the most reviled pieces of integrated software ever made, but it definitely was there. It was an attempt. I mean, it was Commodore seeing, people want the computer bundled with some applications, even if they're completely horrible.
Right.
Okay, so before we move on, is that it on the comments, Earl?
I would think it's just interesting to note that, this sort of software, these work suites, definitely were a product of the limitation of computers at the time. They are still around and are still popular, and then sort of have morphed into collections of software. I mean, Microsoft Office is individual standalone programs, but ones that interact so closely, you can almost think of it as a work suite. Same thing with iWorks, the stuff that with Apple. You can look at the Adobe suite. I mean, they even sell it as a single item that costs a crazy amount of money that I have to buy every year. And it's all about that interoperability. So they're just letting the operating system now be the thing that ties them together so they can be standalone programs. But they kind of essentially work the same way.
I don't remember.
Just, so they are still around.
I don't remember what year it was that Bill Gates was talking about, and that this concept wasn't revolutionary, but he was definitely embracing it and saying Microsoft was going to push for it. That you would not think of your computer as application centric; you'd think of it as data centric or document centric. Mm-hmm. So that you'd have a document, and if you wanted to do a spreadsheet kind of thing with your document, then you could do that, and then there would be a word processing sort of thing in the same document, and you would think more about the data than you would about the applications that were running. And I think that's one of the reasons why they pushed toward that Olay stuff that you guys were talking about.
But ironically, I think the thing that has kept people away from that are the application manufacturers who want to sell the single, monolithic, very expensive. I mean, it's Microsoft themselves that have sort of held people back from switching to that model because everybody uses Office, and Office works a certain way, and
that's true.
Yeah,
and in Office, I haven't looked recently, but I know you have the consumer.
Still sucks.
They used to call it the student teacher edition. Now it's the consumer version. It's $200 maybe, so it's reasonable nowadays. But so another part of that why Works existed because, man, people forget in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s and stuff, a copy of Word was $300.
Crazy. Yeah.
I mean,
that stuff was really expensive.
Like
you can get for $99 a year for 5 copies. They're doing a subscription thing now, which is a whole other kettle of fish. But
all right, so that was a good topic. So
if you say so yourself.
Yeah, I thought it might be a little on the weak side, but then I was like, okay, that's cool. So moving along,
we do have some comments.
Oh, hit us with comments.
Yes,
share them.
Oh, yeah, Valdox. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, there you go.
I work for Epson in the Valdox days. Completely forgot about that one. Yeah, and the Epson QX10 and the QX16.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Valdox was actually way, way ahead of its time in terms of being WYSIWYG and all that. Unfortunately, its programming was a little too ahead of its time, so it was kind of slow on the platform, and also every now and then it would just forget your documents. They would just go away. We said, you know, we joked at Epson that while other people were working on artificial intelligence, we were working on artificial stupidity. The computer would forget.
I've never heard that before. I've only heard good things about it.
Valdox, but, cool software, but very frustrating when it forgot your documents. Just taking a small dirt road topic here, Valdox gave you long file names, but the operating system that it worked under didn't support long file names, so they had a database that would map your long file name to a short file name. Every now and then that database would get corrupted. Oh. And so it looked like your documents were gone. If you knew how to get in there under the hood, you could recover them. But to the casual user, they'd be like, where'd all my documents go? It was kind of nice.
It's amazing how many of these things were around, though. Like, I'm thinking about them now with, like, Redbox Office. Like, so many of them.
And a lot of inexpensive knockoff ones, too. The Tandy one I just looked up, it was called Deskmate.
Oh, Deskmate. That was it. Right. It was bugging me. I couldn't remember.
Yeah.
Grumpier Than Now thinks Beagle Brothers only made one PC program ever called File Mover.
I've heard that before.
Let me see. What else have we got here? We got a number of comments. David Grealish posted, he said, I love this show. You guys have great chemistry. Thanks, David.
Who cares what that guy thinks?
Really? How did someone do that?
Also, Rob, we did get your email on your horror story. I don't know if we'll talk about that today or if that'll be on the next podcast, but we got that, and I shuddered when I read that. Rob Clark had sent in a horror story about the wholesale wanton destruction of a retro computer, and we'll yak about that at some point.
How is someone posting as me?
I'm living your life, dude.
I'll have to look into that, because it wasn't me.
Seriously? It wasn't
no.
me?
No.
So they were David Grealish?
I haven't made any...
That's funny.
So Carrington, take it away, the next topic.
Is it me? Oh, sure, right. This is news that came out around the time of our last show, but I think we didn't talk about it. So let me know if I'm wrong. But Nolan Bushnell, you know, Atari fellow, did you guys know he's about to come out with a book about Steve Jobs?
No.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a new book called Finding the Next Steve Jobs. I don't know if the next there is supposed to be a pun or not. And it's about to come out, and he's publishing it on a different sort of platform. So he's publishing it on something called NetMinds, which is a crowdsourced publishing platform that's just launched by Yahoo. So like all of this was news to me. I'm like, well, what's going on? So there's NetMinds, which is a new form of publishing, and one of the big books that's about to come out on that is Finding the Next Steve Jobs by Nolan Bushnell. So this is all totally news to me. It's coming out only as an ebook. It's about to come out. I don't know what the cost of it is, because it's hard. I find on the NetMind site, which is just netminds.com, NetMinds. I don't know if I don't have the right plug-in, but I can see it, but I can't get any details about the stinking book. I just know it's coming out in March, so it's coming out real soon. And I thought it was really interesting that a fellow who's got, I think, enough of a name and history behind him that certainly he could have put out a traditionally published book. It's interesting that he's decided to go a different way, go with this NetMind thing that's coming from. So, yeah, well, so I just thought it was really interesting.
Steve Jobs worked for Bushnell for a while?
I know that they interacted, and I've seen lots of interviews with Bushnell who will then talk about Steve Jobs and him coming into when Atari was in trouble and that kind of stuff and talking and things. This whole book was news to me. So.
With Breakout, I thought that Steve Jobs worked on that and then like subcontracted to Woz. Steve Jobs was at Atari for a while.
I know they went to Atari to try to get funding or whatever, but I guess we'll find out when the movie comes out, which will be so accurate.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
So, anyway, NetMinds was news to me, and I thought that was interesting. But more interesting was the fact that Nolan Bushnell, in a matter of a couple of weeks, is coming out with a book about Steve Jobs. And that flew completely under my radar. I have actual radar. So what about you, David? You're the Steve Jobs fanboy of the three of us. were you aware of this book?
I was just looking at the article because I just got done
taking care of something there.
Taking care of business, a little TCB.
So, well, apparently I needed to change my Google password, I guess. So, I was not aware, and I'm sorry, so I missed it. Did it say when it was coming out?
Yeah, in March. It's coming out in a couple
weeks.
Okay,
in March. And are you both going to go see the Steve Jobs movie? That is opening the weekend of the VCFSE.
And I hear that at every single cinema showing it, you know how like when Wreck-It Ralph came out, at some cinemas they would post one of those things behind me on this side, the Fixit Felix Jr. arcade machines. I hear at the cinemas where they're showing the Jobs movie, they're like a little tiny pop-up museums.
Wait for it. I knew something was coming. Oh, Steve Jobs lookalikes. Do you think people dress up like Steve Jobs go to that movie? That would be kind of in poor taste, wouldn't it?
To dress up like Steve Jobs? Well, to dress up like him now, maybe. If you dress up like him back when he was alive and not
they carry him in.
Zombie Jobs, it's not in that bad taste.
But are you both planning to go see the movie?
I'll see it, sure. Yeah, I can't keep away. I'm going in with some trepidation, but I'm definitely going to see it.
Okay.
So anyway, Nolan Bushnell, we'll have a link over to a Forbes article, which is where I learned about it. But now there's things all over the net about it. It was something that I was surprised somebody with a name as big as his talking about somebody with a name as big as Jobs didn't seem to be getting any press about this.
So Earl, you take it away now. I saw this article in Wired.
What about? Oh, I'm talking about the Wired article, which was really cool and nice pictures.
Yeah.
So apparently, retro computing, specifically restoration, is making the mainstream press now. And I love Wired anyway. I just love their articles. So they had a nice article about the strange beauty of restoring old computers. We'll have a link to it, obviously, in the show notes. And one of the interesting things to me about this article, not only did they cover some of the activities that are going on at the big museums, like the Computer History Museum and one of the big ones over in the UK where they restored the Witch, mm-hmm. but they also talked about smaller restoration efforts, like the Bill Degnan actually mm-hmm. got some coverage there and what they're doing at March with some of the retro computer restoration. I thought that was cool. They showed his IMSI connected up to a Teletype ASR33. Anyway, great article, nice pictures, so you should get right over there and see it. Of course, you should wait until the podcast is over. And
no, you should go right now.
Do it.
That's right. We have multitasking now, as Carrington reminded us.
Yes.
Just to mention, Bill Degnan.
Fantastic pictures, yes. Holy cow, fantastic pictures.
In one of these pictures, the photo shows a restoration of I think it's this one, the Vector machine, and mm-hmm. and then he made a comment, I think in their discussion forum or the vintage computer one, that he hadn't restored at all. there's just a picture of one of his computers, and they got that part wrong. That it was one that he had restored, but you know, no press is bad press.
That's true, and you know, if it's a little inaccurate on the details, I mean, he's restored so many computers. You've mm-hmm. read about his efforts over time. I mean, some of the mm-hmm. stuff that they've put back together is amazing. So,
mm-hmm.
but these pictures were just gold to look through. It's got a picture of one of the big digital Deckwriter 2s, the big plotters with the keyboard.
I was drooling over that. I love those.
I know. It's just the kind of thing that I want by my front door where I come home and all my tweets are on it or something. Just like, I just adore the look of that thing. Just,
my wife doesn't understand why I want one of those standing printing terminals from Deck, but I was like, A, it's my college days. B, that sucker just looks amazingly cool.
It really does. It's just I adore them. So, yeah, I would strongly recommend people check out the show notes and find the link over to the Wired article because it is just gorgeous, gorgeous photos.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if the Computer History Museum, if it was anywhere else, would they have access to as many of these older guys that know how to do this sort of thing?
Oh, good question.
I kind of think not.
It is an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, in the UK, they do. I mean, if you follow their tweets and that, they've got a lot of brain power over there. But Bay Area, you're right. It's a nexus.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it seems obvious.
Have you guys seen that documentary Silicon Valley yet on PBS?
No.
I did. It's excellent.
Wow. And yeah, you got to see that.
Sorry for the phone going off there. Oh, it's no excellent, worries. Carrington. If you haven't seen it, you can watch it right off PBS's site.
I'm going to hang up now and go watch that. Screw you both.
Oh, they won't have something stupid where you can't watch it because you're not in the U.S., will they?
Probably not.
It's really good. It's in fact, it's become one of my favorite documentaries, you know, up there with The Machine That Changed the World.
David, it's your daughter who spoofed you.
Oh, how do you know that?
That's funny, because she posted. She said, sorry, I posted that message from David. His account was still logged in from the last show.
That's awesome.
Oh, maybe it's my wife. It must be my wife, because remember I was using two computers?
Wait, am I pronouncing it right? Tamara?
Yeah, it's my wife.
Oh, that's your wife. It's not your daughter. Oh, yeah. That's still hilarious. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, awesome.
Gotcha.
Tell her to post the password.
At least that's
good
to know.
Yeah, could you post the password? That would help us. If you
It would help us all log in.
Yeah, she's actually working today. She's doing an extra – she's doing like a 12-hour shift. Not to go into a lot of detail why, but overtime. Hey.
Yeah, that's good.
All right, let's move along. So I think it's me up next. So, yes. And I was contacted by a young guy here in town. His name's Ryan Pickren. And so I said I'd mention about, because this is neat. It's an app for the iPhone called iCapture. And it's basically an app inspired by the 1980s Commodore PET's Capture. So relive the 80s with the arcade-like retro graphics. You ever heard of this before, Earl? I mean, as far as the PET's Capture? I don't know a lot about it myself.
I've never heard of the original that they're basing this off. I'll have to go look that up.
Good thing is the flat glass of an iPhone feels pretty much like an original PET keyboard, so you'll feel right at home.
Yes.
It's got the same amount of feedback.
Excuse me, but it looks kind of neat, and it's got a few reviews that are all positive, so check it out, 99 cents.
So what kind of game is it? I'm unfamiliar with Capture.
I don't know. Me too. But it looks to be... are you looking at the pictures? I don't know. How would you describe it?
Nope. You're on your own. I'm throwing you under the bus. I've moved on.
Well, let's just... Here's one review that was a 5 stars and says, this app is great for picking up girls. One day this attractive woman wanted to play with me and I showed her this app.
Okay.
Well, there it is.
And she later licked my lot. No. Come
on. What? What have you chosen?
All right.
David?
Well, there's some post editing for you, David.
And no, I didn't say it said mentioned a lollipop, but still there's.
Yeah. Yes.
In any case, check it out. It looks like it might be a fun little game that's retro related. So. All right, Earl, take it away about the Raspberry Pi.
And don't look at the reviews.
Oh, no, Carrington, I'm sorry. Sorry, I jumped. Carrington's turn, the return of square monitors.
Oh, Carrington. Yes, I do want to bring that up. It's something that's been on my mind lately because I've been looking at and building MAME machines and that kind of stuff, and old arcade stuff generally runs on square monitors. And, of course, modern monitors are often difficult to hook up to older computers, and a lot of software, especially when you go seriously vintage, a lot of things really do prefer a square monitor. So I've hung on for a while now to an old 20-inch HP monitor I had that has a lot of various inputs and could take just a raw composite feed and stuff like that, composite feed, and it looks quite good. But it's getting harder and harder to get monitors. Every once in a while, you want to get something that's not 16:9, that you don't want widescreen. You're looking for something square. And a company, Hannes G, I guess it's pronounced, H-A-N-N-S and a capital G, which presumably means it's German, has come out with a new line of square monitors. So it's interesting that they're seeing that there is a market for such things. So the specific model number, if you want to go search for it, is the HX193DP8. We'll have a link in the show notes, of course. It's a 19-inch monitor, and there's nothing particularly fancy about the monitor. I mean, it's 250 nit brightness or whatever, 1,001 contrast ratio. It's your fairly standard square PC monitor. It's got a 1280 by 1024 resolution, which makes it a 5:4 ratio. But it's just a seriously old-school monitor, and I like the fact that it's come out now, because it, every once in a while I've actually searched for something like that. If you're building a main machine, you want to get something more square, and for older software, that kind of stuff. So I'm excited that this has come out, like a decent modern LED with a modern warranty. And you pick up, it's goes for £100, basically $99.99 including VAT, so not a massively expensive monitor either, and has game mode and PC mode and that kind of stuff, and it's VESA wall mountable, so it's got all the modern doodads, but in a nice 5x4 ratio. So I'm quite chuffed that that exists.
I'm feeling pretty chuffed myself.
It's chuffy. Now, I don't know this. I don't know this company at all.
You know, I've got dual monitors, you know, connected up to my PC for work.
Just dual? I hate dual monitors, because you either have like a main one and something off to the side, or if you make them equal, you've got a gap in the middle. I'm way too anal for that. I need odd numbers of monitors.
Gotcha.
Three.
I've only got two, but one of them is the old 4x3 ratio, and I like it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I'm just...
Well, also for me, like, I use a lot of my monitors rotated. Like, the big TV behind me, like, my latest MAME project is using a 46-inch television. And I have that mounted vertically on the wall because I was on a stand, but I play mostly older arcade games, and a lot of them are in vertical alignment, so I've chosen to use it that way. But I frequently have my monitors rotated. Both Mac and Windows, the modern ones, make it very easy to rotate your display. And I do more things that require more up and down stuff than left and right things, other than sometimes for software development or video editing, and I prefer the wider screen, and I just rotate it back. But throughout the day, I do a lot of word processing, a lot of working on like sort of long spreadsheets and that kind of stuff. And for that kind of data, it's much more convenient to have a taller screen than a wide one. But frankly, I would just like to have a really big square one.
Mm. Of course, you made me think of in the old days, you know, I guess mostly in the Mac world, the full-page display.
Yep.
Then the two-page display, which were like, you know, insane.
Remember the Radius stuff?
I was just thinking about Radius. Absolutely, the Radius.
And Rasterops?
I had both Radius and Rasterops monitors. We used, as a family, we used to own a company called Valpak, the coupons in the mail. So that started on my parents' kitchen table, actually. And when we, by the time we sold it to our then partners, I think it's either Prudential or Cox, we were doing, you know, direct-to-plate, first direct-to-film and then direct-to-plate processing, that kind of stuff. And that was the era of the Mac 2CI was the program, or the computer we used mostly for that word processing, to do, you know, tens of millions of coupons a year through North America. And a lot of those were using Rasterops stuff. Like, Rasterops was the big monitor cards and monitors at the time, these big 19-inch ones that would weigh 9,000 pounds and go like 90 feet back from a computer. Just crazy.
And they're really expensive, too.
Yep.
All right, so everybody, not be too Mac-centric this show. So who's up next? I guess it's your turn, Earl.
What am I talking about now? Filing.
The Raspberry Pi gets RISC OS.
Yes. Yes, indeed. It did.
None of us know what we're talking about. Keep it in mind, David.
What am I here for? Yeah, thanks. Thanks, David, for driving the bus. So the Acorn machine had RISC OS, was quite popular, kept going, kept being updated and all of this throughout the years. And now the platform that may carry it into these next few years is the Raspberry Pi. They've ported RISC OS over to it, and people are very excited about this. I've yet to try it. I think maybe that'll be an afternoon project for me today on my Raspberry Pi, which I'll be showing off in the post-show, what do you call it, the show and tell. But, you know, for those watching right now, here's my Raspberry Pi. You guys see that? I love
very
this
nice
little guy.
Yeah, I really like the case, too.
This acrylic case, I got it on YouTube. I got it on YouTube. I can't talk today. I got it on eBay for $11, including shipping. So
it's like the official case, right?
It's not. It's some dude who did it, but he did a really good job.
Mm-hmm.
You can find a lot of variations on eBay for this guy.
I must have it.
Yeah, I love this guy.
A comment in that article at TechCrunch where Steve Scott, senior PHP developer, says, it's interesting how this news is being touted and playing that this OS is 25 years old as if nothing happened to it since.
Oh, exactly. Good point.
It, exactly, because it has kept going throughout the years, but I think that same comment points out that the Raspberry Pi may be the platform that this thrives on for for the future.
But it had to be updated, in fact, to be ported over to the Raspberry Pi, right?
I think so.
I guess, or at least it was,
At a minimum, they needed to work out some of the drivers in that, I'm sure. But, again, it's ARM-based, so once again, the legacy of Acorn continues.
It's funny, when I think Acorn, I really don't think about the RISC OS. I mean, I don't think of him as having Acorn having anything to do with 32-bit operating systems. I think of them as the BBC Micro and the Acorn Electron. Like, that's what jumps to mind with that brand for me still to this day. It's the Micro and the Electron. That's it. So.
Well, and those were neat computers. And we are kind of retro-minded.
Though I never used an Acorn Electron. I used a BBC Micro, actually in the UK, but never here in Canada. I don't even know if they came to Canada. But I've never actually had my hands on an Acorn Electron. Never once.
Now, have you mentioned before, so you lived in the UK for a while?
I went to university there for a while. One of my degrees is from the University of Sheffield, of all places. There's nothing in Sheffield except, sorry for our listeners in Sheffield, but frankly, to me, it was university and a spoon museum, and that's it, and a train that would take me to London. There's no reason to go to Sheffield.
Well, what part, how far from London is that then? Or where? I don't know England very much.
It's too far. I don't know. It's a trade and a book ride, and a book read. So, yeah, I wasn't a big fan. But, yeah, I took my second maths degree. It was at Sheffield. But, yeah, but well there, I got to play with an old BBC Micro at a friend's house. And so I'd gone over to visit him, and I got to play with it. So I finally got my hands on it many, many years later. But the Acorn Electron, I know about, and I could recognize one from pictures, but I've never actually got to play with one. Have either of you guys any experience, the hands-on, with either the BBC Micro or the Electron?
No, I wish.
I don't, no. I've never seen one in person.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the BBC Micro. I always like the form factor, I like the keyboard, I like the software on it, I like the sort of the world behind it. I'm a BBC fan and a fan of the BBC Micro. I expect I would like the Acorn Electron, but I've never actually used it. So.
I assume there's not very many of either of those here in the States. And or North America in general, right?
Thank you for including us.
Well, I had to think about that for a minute, but there's not very many over here because you also use the UK standard of power and
As far as I know, neither of those were ever actually sold in North America. I could be wrong, but I don't think they were.
They talked about that whole family tree in Microman, didn't they?
The Microman.
That movie.
The tiny Microman. I know they never talked about it in Micronauts, but that's a different thing.
David, you're the man who turned me on to that movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
I haven't
watched it in a while, but I need to watch it again because it's really good. Because I don't remember all the different computers in there. Of course, you had Clive Sinclair on Sinclair, whatever his company is called. It went through a couple different names, and then you had Acorn, right, making the BBC Micro was most of the story, wasn't it?
Yeah, lots of drama there between Sinclair and Acorn.
Right.
Yeah. And what was the main guy from Acorn, his name?
Man, I can't remember.
I don't remember. The actor
Chris
is the guy who's...
Curry, right? Chris Curry?
Yeah, yeah. And he's the actor who plays...
Martin Freeman.
Frodo, right? He's in The Hobbit?
Martin Freeman, yes.
he's in The Hobbit. Is it Frodo he's playing?
He's Douglas Adams. Think of him that way. No, not Douglas Adams. Arthur Dent.
Yeah, he's Arthur Dent, too.
Yeah.
All right, our last item of interest and news here is an article on Macworld just in the last couple of days by our friend Binge Edwards, and either you guys see this one? It was just 2 days ago it came out. So it's tablets, mice, and trackpads. More Apple stuff, sorry. The evolution of Apple pointing devices. And so it's just pictorial, but it's pretty interesting.
Does it show pictures of the round mouse?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That awful, awful, awful iMac mouse. I still think that is a disaster of a mouse.
Yeah, it was never good.
Yep.
I stopped using mine pretty soon. And then you remember they made like a little clip on thing you could buy to snap onto it?
to give it some orientation.
Give it kind of a more.
Yes, it would extend it down.
It wasn't the last disaster though. I don't particularly care for the Mighty Mouse. The Bluetooth. You know, well, this the guy, Mighty Mouse. I don't particularly care for this guy.
The Mighty Mouse isn't the current one, though. The Magic Mouse is the current one. But the Mighty Mouse, I thought, was the one with that little tiny nipple of a trackball. That was terrible, because that thing would stop working. Any little bit of anything in there, just air in there, would make that thing break. It just, And I found the side buttons. I'm making a hand, so side buttons. Just so hard to use, to squeeze, and that ergonomically, just a terrible. Apple is a terrible mouse manufacturer.
I couldn't do a right click on this guy for the life of me. I mean, it has right click, but when you try and do it, it was just horrible to try and angle it just on the Mighty Mouse.
I have a Magic Mouse at the moment that I use sometimes, and I'm okay with it, and I find it works fine, and I like the idea of the flat top surface with nothing on it, but frankly, just a good solid Logitech mouse. I'm just old school enough that it feels better in my hands.
Agreed.
And I'm showing.
And frankly, I find I'll go off and buy like a $10 wired Logitech mouse and be much more productive with that than.
That's what I'm holding up—a generic $10 mouse right here.
Yeah.
In this case, Lenovo, but you know, it's just a basic,
newfangled, nice,
goofy mouse. And also, I like the wheel. You know, a great innovation. I think Microsoft deserves credit on this, don't they?
Microsoft is a great mouse maker. Even back in the years when I was seriously anti-Microsoft, I still like their mouse. The mice. They're a great mice maker.
And high quality, because you can find ones that were from like the 80s. That are still working.
Yep.
That didn't break down. We
got
some
really
comments.
Old PS2 ones. You can just get a little USB adapter and they'll work perfectly for another 100 years.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So,
read the comments.
Oh, well,
did I make any more comments?
Guy 19. No, you made one where Tamara was correcting me that it's your wife and not your daughter.
Right.
And sorry about that. Did you Photo Guy 19 says, I think they also have the Plan 9 operating system for the Pi. I didn't know about that. Grumpier Than Now, I've never seen that movie. I really want to see that movie. I've heard it's so terrible, it's good. Grumpier Than Now says that he had a BBC Micro for a summer as a kid that he borrowed from school and kind of liked it, but didn't use it nearly enough, didn't have a disk drive, kind of like you with your Commodore 64, David, it was kind of a bummer when you turn it off and all your stuff are gone.
Or someone steals it.
Yeah, or somebody swipes it. That's even worse. They wouldn't have swiped it if you had an Apple. I mean, let's face it. People really want the Commodore. So
I could have left it on the back porch, right? It alone.
Yeah, you could have put a sign on it that said free. And anyway. Wow, Carrington's not jumping in to call me out on that.
We're waiting.
I'll give you that one.
All right.
We all know.
So moving along.
Yeah. And plus we talk about is Apple in the show today, so I'm just letting it go.
Little
Commodore stuff would be good. Good for the rounding it out.
You're looking at a small portable computer called the IBM 5100. It's helping a lot of different people do their work more productively.
Managing real estate investments entails many difficult decisions. Do I pay it now or later? What about the landscaping? Can we afford it? What about taxes? There are many, many difficult decisions to make. It's really nice having a computer to help.
It weighs about 50 pounds. You can plug it in anywhere.
Bad weather, late deliveries, construction delays of all kinds.
How is it going to affect our schedule?
Now we can find that out fast.
The 5100 can help handle some very complex information.
Jet fuel is expensive. At Simmons Precision, we're developing a product that'll help the pilots save fuel. Flight test time is also expensive. But we do our flight tests right here in the lab on our 5100 and save time and money.
Capacity? About the same as some large computers a few years ago.
We're a mid-sized life insurance company. If we want to compete, and we do, we've got to be flexible. We've got to get answers fast. This little machine will help us do it.
The 5100 is easy to learn and simple to use.
There are countless combinations of feed we can mix. What is the most economical for any particular herd? That's what I'm figuring out now.
The cost of the 5100 is reasonable.
Paper, ink, size, weight, overhead, and don't forget the shipping cost. Estimating a printing job is not so easy. Our estimators handle 50% more work since we got the 5100.
We do it faster and a lot more accurately, and our customers really love it.
The IBM 5100. It's bringing the advantages of the computer to more and more people. IBM, helping put information to work for people.
So let's change that. We're going to move into the retro computing gift idea, which is my turn, and it is the Cardiac, a cardboard illustrative aid to computation, and it is sold by Edmunds Scientific. Have you guys ever heard of them?
Absolutely.
So they have been around a long time. They are, I guess you could say, famous for what was called the Geniac and the Brainiac.
Yeah, they've been around since the 40s, I think, like forever.
Edmund C. Berkeley's design. Yeah. So check this out. You can buy one of these little guys on sale for $14 if you like.
So what does it do?
It gives like a basic tutor's not the right word. Let's read what it says. It says, harken back to the earliest days of computer technology with the Cardiac, published in 1968, this rudimentary outline and cardboard model illustrates the operation of a computer from the earliest understanding.
Wow, going back.
Doesn't tell me what it does.
I've never used one,
it
so I'm
stuff.
Not sure how to explain
stuff.
It.
I like stuff. Do you like stuff?
I think it basically gives you an illustrative way of showing like how a very basic calculator would work. Like carrying
cool.
over the integers and all that kind of stuff.
I do recommend Edmund Scientific's. It's a good site to go to if you want to look at. They have like science kits, and so you can get. They have lots of different sort of chemistry kits, electronic kits, that kind of stuff. So it can be a good source to sort of see what's available because they have a very wide range that they sell.
And maybe I'm getting confused because it's Edmunds Scientific, so I guess it's not necessarily related to Edmund C. Berkeley.
No, I don't think it's related at all. I think it's just
that's
science.
Fine.
Yeah, no, just science toys and science kits and that kind of stuff around since the World War II days.
So my mistake, I guess, Cardiac, Brainiac, Geniac, and Edmund was getting me kind of...
Yeah, no, I don't think there's anything with that.
The same.
I think it's more, they used to make their own chemistry kits and electronic kits, and I don't think they make them anymore. I think they sell other brands, but it's still, I think of them as like the science kit place.
Right. And so, but along those lines where the Brainiac and Geniac were actually electric. I guess, were they electronic, technically? They're at least electric, but this kind of does it just without any kind of electricity or anything, the basics. So anyway, check that out.
Well, on the basics, without electricity, so I think I'm either a good or a bad influence on my daughter. I haven't decided which, but I showed her a slide rule online. And she's like, oh, that is so cool. I've got to get one of those. So she and I pooled our money, and we bought a slide rule off eBay. And it just came a couple days ago. And she's so excited about learning how to use it and taking it to school and showing her teacher and her classmates.
Neat.
You know, this is how they did it back in the day.
That is seriously old school.
I know. It's awesome. I was
so
like,
she can be an engineer on a desert island now.
Well, I told her that, and then she burst my bubble. I said, this thing will work without batteries. And she said, well, so will solar-powered calculators. I was like,
you've raised a smarty.
Yeah, so what? But, yeah, I'm relearning because I actually did, like, way, 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 way long ago know how to use a slide rule.
It's been since, like, high school since I've used a slide rule. And
I know, but it was so cool seeing one again, playing with it. And there's a couple of really good sites online for, refreshing your memory.
I would have to have my memory refreshed. I couldn't use one at the moment, I think.
Either you guys have an Android device, because there's a great app that's like a virtual slide rule.
No, I went iPhone.
Okay.
Well, then I was trying to look up, I think slide rule collectors, don't they have a real interesting name? Anyway, I don't find it real quickly.
I believe they're just lumped under single.
You mean the class of people who collect them?
I thought so.
There are some amazing collections out there.
They're called something, but...
And some of the slide rules that you find, like computing, I have no idea what's going on in that world, but like retro computing, some were cheap and some were enormously expensive, very desirable to have. So. Anyway, a little segue.
Well, we're going to move along now into the eBay items we have. So, Carrington, you start off.
Okay, sure. I am sticking with the British, since we talked about the BBC Micro. I have decided to go with a Multitech Microprofessor. Are you guys aware of the Microprofessor?
No.
I don't think so.
This is, it's not really a British thing.
It looks familiar, though.
For sale in Britain.
Case.
Yeah. There's a couple of them. This is the MPF2, and they were Apple II clones. But what I like about the Microprofessor, partly because the name, the Microprofessor, that's pretty awesome, but they are one of those clones that doesn't look at all like an Apple II. They went their own way with the keyboard. They went their own way completely.
Oh, yeah.
So I like that. Most Apple II clones were sort of knockoffs of the outside of the Apple II as well, whereas the Microprofessor, which came out, I think the first one came out late. Like, these are like from 86, 87, something like that. So it was late in the game they came out. But have weird and not necessarily good keyboards. I've never actually used one myself. This is the MPF2. Right now it's going for £23. So if you're in Europe and can get decent shipping from this, it doesn't exactly have a massive bid, but it's still 6 days and 6.5 days left in it. I like the form factor in that it's something totally different. So if you're a collector of Apple II clones, this one would stand out. It's unfortunately quite yellowed, but it also does have like the little floppy disk side plug-in adapter. And so it seems like, and one of the photos shows it turned on, connected to a monitor, and so it proves that it works. And I like that about a vintage computer when you know it's actually working. So, yeah. So something very, you don't see a lot.
I haven't tried it. It's actually in Finland. Did you see that?
I did not.
Tampereheim, Finland.
Okay.
It's on the UK.
On a UK site, so I think that's why. So we'll have a link in the show notes. But if the shipping wasn't outrageous to Canada, it was something like $30 shipping if I want to bring it to me. So it's not a crazy amount, I think. I suspect that this will go more than the current bid of only £23, but probably not a ton. I don't know if these are super collectible. I just think they're interesting because it's a totally different way to go with Apple II clones.
And that's kind of interesting because to me, in Georgia, it's $60.
Yeah, but who wants to ship to Georgia?
Look, my wife just sent me a message. It's called about the slide rules, called the Otred Society, I guess, are the collectors.
Ah.
So I guess it's the name of the society, not the collectors themselves.
Ah.
One thing, did you see the picture of, back to the Microprofessor, mm-hmm. the disk drive, and it has like what looks like a modem on top of it, but I guess that's like the interface to it?
Yeah, there's a little weird connector thing, like it's and then it connects
to
the side.
Oh, I see, side, okay.
Yeah, it's an odd beast, and they're not big. Like, the picture would make it look larger than it is. This thing's like the size of the Sinclair ZX series, and with one of those tiny little weird offset keyboards, not like a chiclet keyboard, kind of the same feel, and they're really small. Just, you know, weird, and it's got the external keyboard that you can plug in, so it's got that as well. It's an odd beast.
Yeah.
For an Apple II thing. I don't know how compatible these were with the Apple II. They're clones, but a lot of times the clones weren't 100% compatible, so I don't know how much it runs, but I think it's neat, and I don't see it much, and I've never actually got to play with one in person.
What was the program? Was there a program that you would run that would be like the acid test of compatibility? Like, I know on the PC, it was Microsoft Flight Simulator. If you wanted to see if a PC was really super hardware compatible with like the IBM XT, you would run Flight Simulator on it.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know if there was one for the Apple II. All I would ever care about was like, will it run Load Runner? Yes, then that is good enough for me.
I think the difference, correct me if I'm wrong, Carrington, is I'm sure, I can't speak for all of them, but I think a lot of the Apple II clones, they were probably 100% compatible because they were totally ripping off the ROMs of a real Apple II.
But they would wire them up different. Because the Apple II itself was
pirated,
kind of
if you will.
So, yeah, but they just wouldn't get the things that didn't work right that software would sometimes count on. So sometimes they would be too accurate. But the Microprofessor is like a small little device, built-in keyboard. We can use an external keyboard. It's got a neat sort of weird collection of stuff that can attach to it, and it's its whole own world, but I've never been able to get my hands on one to play with it in person. So
get it.
No.
Buy it.
No, I do not need more stuff.
So, Earl, tell us about this IBM Paperweight. I love the color.
Yeah, I have a weakness for chips that are encased, if you will, in amber. You know, that kind of display technique where you take the processor or the chip or whatever and encase it in acrylic. It's beautiful to me. I have a keychain, in fact, a key fob that I've carried around for probably since the 90s now with an NEC RISC chip in it. I just think it's awesome. So I saw this. It's like, wow, that's beautiful. In this particular case, it's some IBM RS6000 chips, which I had a chance to play around with a couple of the different variants of the RS6000 back in the day. And it was a powerful type of computer.
Wait, so is this literally a paperweight?
Yes.
I thought David was joking. So this is actually like a paperweight with chips in it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A paperweight with some of these chips encased in an acrylic-like sort of display. And
I see, right. Chips in lucite. Okay.
You're right, David, that the color of that is nice, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep. And it's already, let me see, it's got 5 days, 19 hours left. It's already got a couple bids and is up to going on $29. So be interesting to see how much this goes for in the end, but I like it.
And I was looking, it looks like the RS6000. These are pretty much 1990s machines, aren't they? Looks like mm-hmm. early the late 90s. And that makes it kind of interesting that it's orange, because you know, to me that always seems like a 1970s color.
That's true.
But I love 60s, that color. 70s. I mean, that's a really nice, it just really looks nice, the whole thing with the gold chips or whatever. And yeah, I'd like to have that.
Yeah, me too.
In lucite.
I'm not sure that I'd, with shipping $40, like to have it, but
I would like to have it. Oh, is that how much it is?
Well, I mean, it's
miles away.
Yeah, it's $29, and to me, it's $6.85 shipping at this point.
Oh, I see. Okay. As I say, it's in California. It shouldn't be too bad to you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see. Last is I chose this time a non-Apple. Is that good, huh? I'm trying to get there. Yeah, so this is a 1996 Hewlett-Packard 200LX palm-top computer. And it's in real nice shape. It's currently at $37, $36.99. It's got 5 days left. You know, it's just a nice example of a mid-90s pocket computer, a handheld. So I think the 100LX was the first version of this. This is a slightly later than the original incarnation of it, but essentially, this is a real PC DOS machine that ran Lotus 1-2-3. That was pretty much its purpose, to be a portable Lotus 1-2-3 device.
Awesome.
And that was pretty amazing, frankly.
So I could run software that I didn't like on the go.
Yeah. Awesome. But, you know, to be able to have, you know, if you were real dependent on spreadsheets and you gave it something in your pocket, and it was a pretty practical device for what it, you know, for...
Maybe I didn't have a spreadsheet in my pocket. Maybe I was just happy to see you.
So not much more to say about it. It's a nice example if you're interested in handhelds. You know, to me, handhelds are nice because they're relatively pretty cheap and easy to get a hold of. You can build a nice handheld, you know, collection pretty cheap and easy.
And they don't take up a lot of space.
Exactly. Right,
that's
right.
That's the beautiful thing about these small computers. I managed to pick up another Model 100 as a spare for my TRS-80 Model 100, which isn't a handheld. It's a laptop form factor, but it's still not as much room to store as like a PET.
This device, being one of those little clamshell ones that opens up, has a tiny keyboard, but technically a larger display than the Model 100 would have. Although the Model 100 is more awesome. I love the 100.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is cool. I noticed that on one of the pictures, it looks like maybe there's a little, is that a crack? Or
a little damage. I just noticed that, yeah. Near the upper, sort of the hinge.
Right, but aside from that, it looks like it's in nice shape.
It looks like maybe it was repaired.
Mm-hmm.
So
like glued? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Odd.
But you know, that type of device was, well, I guess it was sort of an I kind of think of it as a parallel to the, like the Palm device, where the Palm was very specific in what it did. Yeah, that's sort of like what it was. You know, because I'm a big fan of the Newton, but the Newton, unfortunately, sort of failed expectations because it was sort of built up and then it didn't really deliver to be a full-fledged computer in many ways that mm-hmm. people wanted it to be. And that's why I think the sort of dumbed-down Palm, you know, was successful because it
sure.
was
people
cheap
wanted
and
the
small
Newton to be the iPhone and the
yeah.
technology just wasn't there. Sure.
And it could do just a few things but very well. And so this device could only really do, you know, that thing, Lotus 1-2-3, maybe a few other things too. and be a PIM, personal information manager. And then, but it did that really well and relatively
cheap. That's a term you don't hear much anymore. The PIM.
Yeah, and that was, remember software like Sidekick and all that? That was that was big there for a while.
Yeah.
That was a big deal to be able to have a, you know, something to organize all your contacts and address book and everything.
Battle of the TSRs.
So, I guess we're to the closing discussions. Carrington, got anything to end on?
I got nothing. My life is incredibly busy at work right now, so I'm so far behind on every project, like every project. I'm like 6 weeks behind on launching two podcasts. I'm so far behind. It's crazy. Luckily, it looks like I've got a week and a half left of the overwhelming, crazy 90-hour work weeks, and then we'll be back into having an actual social life. I look forward to it. It will be awesome.
Well,
I
tell
remember
us again,
the outside world.
Tell us about the display you have behind you then. So what are you doing with that?
Oh, yeah, between my two arcade machines, I'm just working on a new MAME system, and I've decided to go differently. Like, normally, you do what I did before with my small bar top. You get a monitor, and the last one I made out of an Xbox. This one's just powered with a normal PC. But I didn't have any normal square monitors lying around, so I was going to just take a normal 6x9 and hang it sideways. But I thought, well, I'm doing that anyway, and I can't do something accurate. Like, I don't have a arcade monitor. I don't even have a CRT or even a television, a normal old school television I could hang. Instead of going accurate, why don't I just try something that gives me a different advantage? So I decided, instead of accuracy, I'll just go for massiveness. So it's a 47-inch television, and just you stand in front of it, it's like, you know, just you play Donkey Kong or Pac-Man or stuff like that. It's just like fills your field of view, and it's a totally different experience. It's really fun. So I'm sort of playing. I don't know how long I'll keep it there, but for the next while, I'm playing games that way, and I'm really digging it.
And you know, I was thinking to myself too that wouldn't it be kind of neat to maybe take that, and obviously it would not be accurate, but if you sort of made a what if they had that type of display in the old days? You made a cabinet around it, but you know,
just a huge cabinet.
But you wouldn't be able to stand right in front of it and.
Well, that's at a good height for me to stand. Like, the way it's mounted at the moment, that I'm sort of looking three-quarters the way up the screen.
But I'm sure
where
you're standing back. Like, how far back?
No,
I
stand right
in
front of it. I stand, like, 2 feet from it. It just overwhelms me. So I kind of do poorly in the games because of that. Sometimes you can't really keep it all in vision. My head's got to keep your head in a swivel when you play. But it's a fun experience. So I've been toying around with if you can't be accurate, you know, what else could you do with a main machine? So that's the latest build. I don't know what I'll do with it long term, but for the next couple of weeks, it's fun to have there.
How about you, Earl? What's new?
Well, on the retro side, I've been having fun going to the Commodore users groups here in town. Just this last Friday, I went to the one that's up in Vancouver, Washington, and lots of fun
stuff. That's not the real Vancouver.
Yeah, it's true. It's just named Vancouver.
What's that one called? I know the Portland one's PDX.
They're both, PDX Commodore Users Group and the Commodore Computer Club, I think, is the other one. I'd have to go back and check the website. But anyway, lots of fun stuff going on there. Jeff, one of the guys who shows up every now and then, came down from Seattle, and he was doing a S-Video mod on his Atari 5200 game console. So
that's cool.
There was some soldering going on, yo. And actually got it to work by the time the meeting was wrapping up. It was amazing. That was fun. And another guy brought, I mean, this particular club is a little bit loose in terms of, it's a Commodore club, but it's kind of like, you know, bring them if you got them. So all sorts of different consoles and computers wind up there, like an Apple III, and the guy who was working with his Apple III, you know, we're all standing around, we're like, you guys smell something? And it's like, something's not right. And he's like, no, it's okay. All of a sudden, poof, this cloud of smoke comes up from his monitor. It's like, yep.
Oh, I thought you were just kidding, because it's an Apple, that's why you're...
No, the magic really smoke good. Came out of his monitor. It was all over.
Well, time for a cap kit, right?
Exactly.
Cool.
A little refreshing.
So how often do they get together?
Both clubs are every month.
Wow, that's pretty cool. That's awesome.
Yeah,
I'm jealous.
It was a lot of fun. What was one of the other things that happened there? There's just so much going on. It was great to see, you know, all my retro buddies. One of my other friends, Dan, had found a PET IEEE cable to connect the PET to the disk drive, and he found it at the Goodwill outlet, which is where you buy stuff by the pound. So he wound up paying like 20 cents for it, and he just gave it to me. He's like, you pay, you know, 20, 30 bucks for those if you get them online. So anyway, lots of fun.
It's surprising you could even find one at a Goodwill or something.
Mm-hmm. So weird that one's just dumped. He's looking at it. I can't believe it. Really? So anyway, what else is going on?
I find the problem with getting things at Goodwill stores, at all that kind of stuff, is they generally separate the cables from the devices. So if you do come across a computer or a disk drive or something for a vintage computer, you'll then have to go and dig through their cable boxes to find the cable that would have come with it, whether it's a power cable, data cable, or whatever.
Hope that you get lucky, right.
And hope you get the right one, yeah. So I remember Flack on his podcast, he did one about going to places like that and looking for vintage stuff and yard sales and things, about how that's one of the big downsides to the vintage shops, like the consignment shops like that, is that they separate the cables from the devices. I've been burned a couple times on that.
Mm. And I guess the other thing is I wanted to throw out thank you to the anonymous donor out there in podcast land who
got
gave
you a kidney.
Me a subscription to Juice GS.
Fantastic.
I am seriously doing the happy dance about this.
It's awesome.
I told Mr. Gagne, you know, that I was humbled and honored, and so I'm throwing out a to whoever that was. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
I have my own subscription, and I love it. I love Juice GS. Like, four times a year, it shows up, and I get excited because I forget that it's coming out because it's long enough between issues. You just kind of forget about it, and then I'll just go to my mailbox, and it's there. I'm like, oh, my goodness. Like, so you get these four joyous surprises a year. The quality is so good. Oh, I'm such a big fan. Love it. Absolutely
and
adore.
Ken told me that one's coming out this next month. So
yeah, I was about to say it should be one that's coming out.
Don't ruin the surprise.
All right, I won't tell you when I get it.
The last one was December.
Right.
So yeah, it should be for March.
So we'd be due. Yeah, but I love it. There's no such thing as an issue of that. Like I get it. I sit down. I read it a couple times through. I just adore it. I love getting it. It's such a good deal.
Yeah. I'm very much looking forward to it. Cool. Anyway, that's what's up with me. What's up with you, David?
Are there any
comments? You're doing some show coming up or something like that, aren't you? I don't think I've got a tweet on that in the last few minutes.
I know, man. I tried to limit it somewhat, but
sorry. Dude.
Basically, all I wanted to bring up is, so I'm doing a lot of work on that, and the big thing has been the Kickstarter, which is ending in. So one last shout out about that. It's ending
coming
in 55
right
minutes,
up, right?
And it's done.
How long?
55 minutes from right now. So, of course, by the time the audio listeners hear this, it's over with.
Right.
But no complaints. It's done really great.
Oh, sure. It hit its funding goal quickly. So.
Yeah. Had an $800 goal. It's at $1,774 right now.
Nice.
A lot of people get some T-shirts early and some tickets in, and then it's going to fund. You know, it's totally serving its purpose as far as it's going to allow us to, you know, buy enough T-shirts for the show, which we're going to sell those and, you know. Pretty much our group, the Atlanta Historical, the AHCS, our group here, is, we're pretty much spending all our money and this money for our share of all the stuff we're doing at the show. So this will help put a little bit more money back in the bank, I guess, for us afterward. But the shirts turned out really good. I got a chance to see them, and I really intended to have one on. But I had worn them this week, so they're in a dirty laundry hamper.
And for the record, I really hope Weird Al shows up at your show.
Oh, did you see that?
That's a hilarious tweet, yes.
I'm like, what the heck, right?
He's got to come, man. He can sing It's All About the Pentiums.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I throw out tweets to people. Let's see what happens.
That was a great line in that song, by the way. Do you know the song I'm talking about?
Uh-huh. Yeah. I remember the line, but I remember the song.
Yeah, that
I'm
line
a huge
that
Weird Al.
What's he say? You think your Commodore 64 is so neato? What chip do you have in there? A Dorito?
I haven't listened to it in a while. I'll have to check it out again.
So we do have some comments, though. Grumpier Than Now said GENIAC apparently stood for Genius Almost Automatic Computer.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
And he said, this is funny, the battle of the TSRs terminated but stays resident. That's hilarious.
That is very good.
Well, play on words. Thank you, Grumpier.
Well done.
Sorry, David.
No, that's all. I think that's it. Right, you read off the... Any other, that's it then on the comments, right? So that's it.
Yeah.
We don't have anything else to talk about.
Oh, no. Are we done?
Yeah.
It's been an hour. How long do you want people to listen to us?
Game over, man. That's what I had. I had show over, man, in the notes. But, you know, that's where it comes from. So, all right. Well, in closing, then... our next show is Sunday, March 17th, in 2 weeks. So remember, you can always join us live at 4 p.m. Eastern and 1 p.m. Pacific. You'll find links to the live broadcast at rcrpodcast.com. We also find links to the forums, as well as we're at rcrpodcast on Twitter. You can send us feedback at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And please say something about us on iTunes or just give us a review. So until next time, Retro Compute.